our scripture reader must be ill tonight. So we'll go on.
Tonight we would like to consider the thought of two very influential thinkers. One is Jesus of Nazareth, and the other is Charles Darwin. And we would like to compare their thoughts along the lines of a particular issue, and that is the origins of the varieties of organisms that exist upon the earth today. In other words, Jesus and Darwin have two competing visions about how all of the living things we observe around us developed to this day. In the first place, let's examine the thought of Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus clearly believed in the Genesis account of creation. That is, he believed that in six literal 24-hour days, God created all of the different kinds of animals. There has been a variation in species over time. There are different species of dogs that were not present then. There are different species of plants that were not present then at the initial creation. But Jesus clearly believed that God created all different kinds of things in the initial creation that lasted six literal 24-hour days. I know that because Jesus said in Mark chapter 10 and verse 6 that from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. And this is in a discussion of marriage. And so the male and female that Jesus is talking about is none other than Adam and Eve. And so Jesus believed that from the beginning of creation, God had created a man and a woman. That means right that at the very beginning. Not eons after the beginning, not millions of years after the beginning, but at the beginning. That is, in that initial week of creation, God had made male and female. Furthermore, in Luke chapter 11, we read about how Jesus said that the blood of righteous people had been shed since when? Since the foundation of the world, or since the beginning? Since the blood of righteous Abel was shed. And everybody here who's a Bible student knows that Abel was the victim of the first murder. And so his blood was shed. When was his blood shed? Right back there at the very beginning. And of course, Zechariah is a reference to 2 Chronicles 24. He was a faithful man of God who was tragically killed, and you can read about that. But it's as if Jesus is saying in modern English, from A to Z, all of these righteous people have had their blood shed, and it goes all the way back to the very beginning. In other words, not eons after the beginning, not millions of years after the foundation of the world, but right there back at the foundation of the world, there was the blood of righteous people being shed. And so Jesus believed in the Genesis account of creation. He believed it was literally true. Furthermore, Jesus talked about some of the very characters from the book of Genesis that are most controversial. And he treated them as if they were historical figures, just real people, as real as George Washington, as real as Christopher Columbus, that they were historical figures, not mythological. Jesus talked about Noah, that he was a real man. Jesus talked about Adam as if he were just a historical figure, like other historical people. Jesus talked also about Jonah in Matthew chapter 12, verses 42 through 44, and that's fascinating because Jonah was in the belly of a fish for 3 days, and Jesus firmly believed that. He believed that there was a man named Jonah who was in the belly of that fish, and he talked about that as a historical event. So what I'm saying is, those parts of the Bible that are most ridiculed, those parts of the Bible where contemporary scientists and contemporary philosophers and contemporary critics of the Bible would look back at the Bible and say, the Bible can't be true. Look at all of that mythological stuff that can't be true in the Bible. Wait a minute. Jesus, the very Son of God, said, here are historical figures. Here are people who really lived and really did those things that the Bible claims they did. So Jesus was a creationist, someone who believed in the young earth, that he believed the creation happened in six literal days because Adam was there from the very beginning. Here's somebody in Jesus of Nazareth who believed in the historical account of the book of Genesis. That's his view. Jesus tied his doctrine to the doctrine of Moses. In John chapter 5, verses 46 and 47, Jesus said that if you would read Moses, you would be reading about me, because Moses wrote about me. In other words, Jesus said, Moses is a historical author who is accurate in what he says, and he wrote about me. What did Moses say in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 11? He said, in 6 days, God made the heavens and the earth and the seas and all that are in them. In 6 days. Now that word for day is the same word that's translated day in Genesis chapter 1. And in Exodus 20, Moses is talking about the 6-day work week and the Sabbath day, making 7 days in a week. And Moses is saying, you need to work 6 days and then rest on the Sabbath, because guess what? That is the same pattern God used when he created the universe. He worked for 6 days and he rested on the 7th day. Now Moses obviously is saying that you need to work for the same amount of time that God worked when he created the world. That shows you clearly that Moses believed that God created the world in 6 literal days, 24-hour days. Otherwise, his statement about the Sabbath day wouldn't make any sense. Because what if every day in Genesis 1 is supposed to be an eon or millions of years, as we're sometimes told? That all the days in Genesis 1 don't mean real 24-hour days. They mean millions of years in which evolution could have occurred. They mean billions of years or eons. A day in Genesis 1 is not a day like we understand it today. A day in Genesis 1 is not 24 hours. Well, wait a minute. Moses said, work 6 days and rest on the 7th day, just like God did. He worked 6 days and rested on the 7th day. Did Moses mean work 6 eons? Did Moses mean work 6 long expanses of time? Work for millions of years. Work for billions of years and then rest for a few billion years. Is that what Moses was saying? No, he was saying work 6 24-hour days and then rest on the 7th day. And of course, he wasn't saying you have to work all 24 hours of those. But the point is, he's saying use those 6 days for labor and rest on the 7th, just like the Lord did. So I say all that to say, Jesus of Nazareth had a particular view of origins. How did all the living things come about? God made them in those 6 days. Now let's transition and talk about Charles Darwin for just a few minutes. Darwin taught that natural selection was responsible for the origin of all of the living things we see around us. And it's all a natural process, an accidental process, a random process that's not guided by any intelligence. No mind governs it. No intellect takes control of it. It is totally random. It's totally accidental. It's a chance process. It is not purposeful. It is not purposive. That is, nobody is guiding it. It just accidentally happens. W.R. Byrd has a good summary of Darwin's view. He says, Darwin's revolution in science grew from the concept that one or a few original single-celled organisms evolved into invertebrates, then into fish, then into amphibians, then into reptiles, then into lower mammals, then into primates, then into man. Darwin speculated, and others proposed, that the original single-celled organisms themselves evolved from non-life. Now that's a pretty big sentence at the end. All of those words are big, but think about that one at the end. Non-living things sort of just changed into living things. That's never been performed in a laboratory, by the way. Nobody's ever been able to produce living things from non-living things, even when they try. The best they can do is to produce amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins, but not even a protein has ever been produced in a laboratory. And the proteins are the building blocks of life. And so Darwin's idea is life just happened accidentally. This is Darwin's book from 1859 called The Origin of Species. Everybody knows the famous title of that book, but did you realize that if you read the whole title, the word natural selection is in the title? It's actually called The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. And when we read the word favored races, we can easily see how the Nazis would have drawn on the work of Charles Darwin. But the phrase natural selection simply means that in nature, the stronger organisms survive. And no Christian would have a problem with that idea of natural selection. If you have 2 beavers and there's only enough food to feed 1 beaver, and which one is going to survive? The stronger beaver is going to survive. That's natural selection. Nobody would have a problem with that. No Christian, no atheist. Everybody acknowledges that's what occurs. But Darwin's idea was that that principle of natural selection would produce all of the different kinds of organisms. That is, just because the stronger animals survive, the stronger critters live, that somehow means that all the different kinds of animals develop. Scientists quickly realized, after Darwin's work became so popular, that natural selection alone wouldn't get it. By that I mean, when the stronger beaver survives, that doesn't mean the beaver gets to develop into anything else. When the stronger bacteria survives, that doesn't mean that the bacteria then, just because it's the stronger bacteria, changes into something that's not a bacteria. Just because a stronger bird survives because he has a longer beak, doesn't mean that the bird changes into something that's not a bird, or that the bird gives birth to something that's not a bird, because birds keep on producing birds, just like Genesis 1 says they will. And so scientists quickly realized natural selection alone will not produce the different kinds of organisms. To quote Hugo de Vries, who was famous as a geneticist and who really came up with the idea of mutations in the early 20th century, he said, "Natural selection may explain the survival of the fittest, but it cannot explain the arrival of the fittest. Natural selection can explain why the stronger bird survives, or why the stronger beaver survives, but it can't explain why there's a beaver. It can't explain why there's a bird to begin with." And so Hugo de Vries and others developed an additional part to add to Darwin's theory. After Darwin was long dead, they came up with the idea of mutations. That is, not only do the stronger critters survive, but mutations or genetic manipulations are introduced over time, and that allows for new kinds of critters to form. Snyder and his co-authors in a biology textbook that was used not very long ago say mutations constitute the raw material for evolution. They are the basis for the variability in a population on which natural or artificial selection acts to preserve those combinations of genes best adapted to a particular environment. Now, just to put that in common, everyday, ordinary language, they would say mutations are the engine for evolution. Mutations make it possible for new kinds of critters to develop out of other kinds of critters. Now, I want to tell you, that has never been observed. No mutation has ever produced a new kind of animal. Rather, even mutated fruit flies, and fruit flies are the easiest to use in a laboratory for mutation tests because they produce so quickly. We can watch millions of generations of fruit flies in a comparatively short amount of time because they reproduce so quickly. And so even mutated fruit flies always stay fruit flies. It never occurs that a fruit fly gives birth to anything else or transforms into anything else. And so the idea that mutations can be the engine for Darwinian evolution is false. But don't take my word for it. Let's listen to some evolutionists talk about this matter. For example, Stephen Stanley, who is from the University of Hawaii, he works in their marine technology or marine science division. Well, he's going to tell us that we've got to be looking at the fossil record for the evidence of this change. We'll talk about why mutations don't work in a minute, but before we do, I had forgotten about this slide. He says you will see the evidence for this in the fossil record because you will see a gradual change from weaker creatures to stronger creatures, from less complex creatures to more complex creatures if you just look in the fossil record. He says we must look to the fossil record for the ultimate documentation of large-scale change or evolution. In the absence of a fossil record, the credibility of evolutionists would be severely weakened. We might wonder whether the doctrine of evolution would qualify as anything more than an outrageous hypothesis. Okay, so now we've set the stage. We've said Jesus taught Genesis creation, special creation, as the book of Genesis teaches. On the other hand, Darwin taught gradual change by way of natural selection and mutations. And the evidence for that, we're told, has got to come in the fossil record. Let's get that clear. Jesus said, look to the book of Genesis, and you'll find the evidence for the origin of all living things. Darwin says, look to the fossil record, and what you'll find is that natural selection, a mindless process, an aimless process, a process with no purpose, no intelligence behind it, will produce all of the living things. And if you look in the fossil record, you'll find evidence that natural selection plus mutations has equaled all of the living things that we see around us. I hope that's clear. But now let us evaluate Darwin's suggestion. Darwin is taught in schools. The National Association of Biology Teachers official position statement, which I got off their website this week, says, even as biologists continue to study and consider evolution, they agree that all living things share common ancestors and that the process of evolutionary change through time is driven by natural mechanisms. That is, we believe as biology teachers who teach our children in schools that it is a fully naturalistic process. God is not involved. God has not guided the development of all living things. Genesis is false. That's their official position, the National Association of Biology Teachers. They say, do not listen to Jesus. Do not listen to Genesis. Rather, Darwin is correct. I want to evaluate that claim in the next few minutes. I want to say Darwin is wrong for several reasons. Jesus is right. Darwin is wrong for several reasons. Number one, mutations do not explain the development of the living things that are more fit to survive. And again, do not take my word for it. Here's Hermann J. Müller, who was a Nobel Prize laureate, a physicist, said, no matter how numerous they may be, mutations do not produce any kind of evolution. Now, that's not a Christian author. That's not a member of the Lord's church. This is somebody who is just a well-qualified scientist who observes. Here is Pierre-Paul Grasse, who was a faculty member at the University of Paris for 30 years, and he sat on the chair of evolution. And what I mean by that, in his department, you know how in academic departments there's a chair for this and a chair for that? He sat on the chair for evolution. And what did he say after or while working for 30 years at the University of Paris? No matter how numerous they may be, mutations do not produce any kind of evolution. Here is Irwin and Valentine, who are researchers in this area, and they presented a paper just a few years ago that was published, and in their paper they say, viable mutations with major morphological or physiological effects are exceedingly rare and usually infertile. Now, that's a mouthful, but let's say what it says. They say, we have a real hard time coming up with any mutations that help an organism be stronger. We just cannot find them. We would love to be able to tell you that mutations are producing all kinds of new, stronger critters all the time, that mutations are the engine that support Darwinian evolution. It doesn't work that way. We sure do wish it did. The chance of two identical rare mutant individuals arising in sufficient propinquity, that is, close enough together to produce offspring, seems too small to consider as a significant evolutionary event. Think about that. What they just said is, even if we could get a healthy mutant that's stronger for having the mutation, the chances that he would be anywhere near another healthy mutant that had the right mutation to help that species be stronger and maybe develop into something else, to put it in the way we would in Alabama, they ain't never going to get together. There's just not a way for there. The chances of them being in the same room is just not, it's not going to work. And so he says, it's embarrassing as evolutionists, but we've got to admit, mutations don't do the job. Number two, life never has been shown to come from non-life. And yet that is required if Darwin is correct. If you want to say Jesus is wrong and Darwin is correct, you're going to have to get life from somewhere. It's easy for Christians, because all we have to do is point back to the Bible and say, Genesis 1 says God spoke life into existence. But for Darwin, it's a little bit harder. Where is he going to get the first life? Here is Werner Gitt, who is also an award-winning physicist, and he says, there is no known law of nature, no known process, and no known sequence of events which can cause information to originate by itself in matter. Why is that important? Because what is DNA but information? And what he's saying is, when you have a strand of DNA, when you have the genetics of an individual, you cannot just introduce new information that never has been there before. The genetic information that we have in the various kinds of animals is the genetic information we have. Any mutation that's introduced is a distortion of the pre-existing genetic information. It doesn't help you to produce a new kind of individual by mutating it because you cannot make any new information. You cannot introduce any new information into the genetic code of that individual. And so he says mutations aren't going to work and we can't get life from non-life because that would require the introduction of new DNA. That would require the origination of DNA out of non-living things. And he just says We've never observed that to happen. There's no known mechanism for doing that. In other words, Darwin's theory can't get off the ground. What does Douglas Hofstadter say? He is from the University of Indiana at Bloomington, and he is also a very well-regarded scientist. He says there are various theories on the origin of life. They all run aground on this most certain of all central questions. How did the genetic code, along with mechanisms for its translation, ribosomes and RNA molecules, originate? In other words, he says, I can show you a number of theories about the origin of life, but they all have this one problem. Where did DNA come from? Where did genetics come from? He says, we don't know. For the moment, we will have to content ourselves with a sense of wonder and awe rather than with an answer. Friends, we've got the answer. We would love to point Dr. Hofstadter to the book of Genesis. I don't know that he wants to go there, but that's where the answer is about the origin of DNA. Darwin is wrong for a third reason. Living things exhibit complexity that randomness could not have produced. Living things exhibit great complexity and interdependence that randomness could not have produced. I want to read to you a statement from Michael Behe, who is an award-winning American biologist. And before I read it, let me tell you, it's not going to be easy to get through, but I'm going to make this point. Michael Behe is talking about what happens when we see. All he's talking about in the paragraph I'm about to read to you is an instance of vision. When I look down and see Brother Billy here, here's what happens. When light first strikes the retina, a photon interacts with a molecule called 11-cis retinol, which rearranges within picoseconds. A picosecond is like a millionth of a second, or even less than that. A picosecond is the time it takes light to traverse a hair. So we're talking about way less than a second. Within picoseconds, it changes to or rearranges to transretinal. The change in the shape of the retinal molecule forces a change in the shape of the protein, rhodopsin, to which the retinal is tightly bound. The protein's metamorphosis alters its behavior. Now called metarhodopsin 2, the protein sticks to another protein called transducin. Before bumping into metarhodopsin 2, transducin had tightly bound a small molecule called GDP. But when transducin interacts with metarhodopsin 2, the GDP falls off and a molecule called GTP binds to transducin. GTP is closely related to, but critically different from, GDP. I've just read to you what occurs when I look at Brother Billy. And Darwin would have us believe all of that happened by accident. The inner workings of the human eye had no purpose. Nobody put that together. Friends, that's more complicated than anything you or I or anybody else who's been a human on this earth has ever put together, the workings of the human eye, and we're told that that's an accident. Notice all those proteins that have to work together. And not only work together, but they have to work together just right in order for this to happen. It could not have come about by accident. Vision would never have occurred. All of those proteins would have had to have been developed by accident all at once, and they would have to all know how to work together at once. Darwin evolution won't get off the ground. Number four, Darwin is wrong for the following reasons. Number four, complex living things appear abruptly and not gradually in the fossil record. This is where we'll conclude tonight, by noticing that in the fossil record, there is not a uniform gradation from simple organisms to complex. That is, when you look in places like the Grand Canyon, you do not see a uniform gradation from the lowest strata of water-laid rocks where the simple critters are to the top layer of rocks where the more complex animals are in a uniform systematic gradation. What you see is there is a lot of complex life at the very bottom. And oftentimes the different strata, which should show a uniform gradual change from simple to complex as that strata was laid down over allegedly millions of years, whereas you should see a slow gradation, gradual change, simple fossils at the bottom, complex fossils at the top, what you find is the fossils of very complex animals are right down there at the bottom. And very often, what you would expect to find if you are an evolutionist is not there at all. Rather, they're jumbled up. You've got various amounts of complexity all jumbled in there together. It looks as though those strata were laid down by something like a global worldwide flood, such as the flood we read about in the book of Genesis. But again, don't take Caleb's word for this. Richard Dawkins, the famous Oxford biologist who is the face of the new atheist movement, says the Cambrian strata of rocks, that is, a strata right down at the very bottom, where all you would find, if you're an evolutionist, all you would expect to find are the very simple kinds of critters. He says, the Cambrian strata of rocks are the oldest in which we find most of the major invertebrate groups, and we find many of them already in an advanced state of evolution, the very first time they appear. Wait a minute, Dr. Dawkins. He says, when you first find them, you don't find their evolutionary ancestors underneath them. You just find them, and they're already evolved. It's as if they have a lot of evolutionary ancestors that we don't find. They just pop in there as if somebody made them, and then they got buried. To continue, it is as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history. Needless to say, this appearance of sudden planting has delighted creationists. No wonder. Here's George Gaylord Simpson, the famous Harvard paleontologist. He says, the facts are that many species and genera, indeed the majority, do appear suddenly in the record, differing sharply and in many ways from any earlier group. Now, he's not a Christian. He's an evolutionist. He agrees with Darwin. And yet he says there's one thing that we evolutionists just can't figure out. We cannot figure out why all of these fossils stubbornly seem to just keep appearing with no evolutionary ancestors. We cannot understand why very complex animals just pop up all of a sudden and you don't find what evolved into them. They just pop in there as if they didn't have any evolutionary ancestors. And why is that? Because, let me just echo, Jesus is right and Darwin is wrong. Let's continue. Niles Eldridge, who also is a famous paleontologist, says, no wonder paleontologists shied away from evolution for so long. It never seems to happen. That is, they just can't find the fossils they need. When we do see the introduction of evolutionary novelty, or a new kind of critter in the fossil record, it usually shows up with a bang, and often with no firm evidence that the fossils did not evolve elsewhere. Evolution cannot forever be going on somewhere else. Now, that's a fascinating line. When he says evolution cannot forever be going on somewhere else, what does that mean? He says we find a critter with no evolutionary ancestors, and then we say, well, the fossils that evolved, that represent the animals that evolved into this, they got to be somewhere else. You know, they just don't happen to be, they didn't fossilize for some reason. And then we find another one in another continent, very complex animal, that shouldn't be down there at the bottom, and we say, well, you know, his ancestors from evolution, the fossils from those critters must be somewhere else. Niles Eldridge makes a very insightful point when he says, it can't always be going on somewhere else. Which is right, Jesus or Darwin? I think we've seen four good reasons to suggest that Jesus is right and Darwin is wrong. And that is because this explanation of the origin of life, that by natural selections through mutation, just does not explain the variety of animals we have. The fossils do not support it. Life has never come from non-life. Mutation cannot account for the development of new kinds of life. And what was the fourth one? Someone tell me the fourth one that we mentioned. Living things exhibit complexity that randomness could never have produced. Those are four good reasons to reject Darwin's account of the origins of life and accept Jesus's. But if Jesus is right about origins, and if Jesus performed all those miracles that he did while he was on the earth, and Jesus is speaking with authority, have you accepted his authority? Have you submitted your life to the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, who, by the way, was the agent by which God created all of the living things we see? John chapter 1 says that by him everything was made, and without him was nothing made that was made. Jesus is the creator. Are you a child of God? Are you a brother or a sister to Christ? Are you a faithful follower of the one who created you? Are you in fellowship with him? You can be tonight. Would you like to be baptized to have your sins washed away? Based upon your repentance and your confession, we will do that for you. Or perhaps you did that at some time in the past and you've left the Lord and you want to come home. Or you have sinned in such a way that is public and you want to get all of that negative influence removed so that you can shine the light of the Lord clearly, that you can honestly say, follow me as I follow Christ. I'm not perfect, but if you'll follow me, I'll lead you to the Lord. Won't you be able to say that to your friends? If you need to make things right with God tonight, absolve any of that negative influence, we'll pray with you and for you. You can go home tonight secure in your salvation, knowing that if you were to die tonight, you would just go on and be with the Lord. If we can help you in any way, come now as together we stand and sing.